thanks for joining me for this week's Admissions Trade Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you get to that delightful instant when you can jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in." And you're not only in, but in at the right program for you. Over the last several months, if not years, the competition for test takers in the MBA market between ETS, makers of the GRE, and GMAC, makers of the GMAT, has really heated up. Both claim to be the best test for those pursuing an MBA and other forms of graduate management education. In addition, the GRE is the aptitude test of choice for a host of graduate programs, certainly throughout the U.S. and sometimes elsewhere in the world. I mean, it's taken by many people from many specialties. Each testing company claims its test is the best for the MBA. The GMAT was the only test for MBA wannabes for decades, but those days are over. Many, if not most, business schools accept both tests, and the GRE is experiencing growth in the MBA market. Today, we're going to be talking to an expert in both the GRE and the GMAT about the role of the test, test prep, and his new GRE venture. But first, I'd like to remind you that if you have an admissions-related question that you would like me to address, just go to the show notes at info.accepted.com/112 and ask your question in a comment on the blog. We're developing a wonderful and thoughtful community on Accepted, so feel free to comment there, ask your question, share a thought, concern, whatever. I'm delighted to have Brett Etheridge, founder and CEO of Dominate the GMAT and now Dominate the GRE. He earned his bachelor's in public policy studies from Duke in 2000 and then joined the Peace Corps for 2 years where he worked in Madagascar. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name of the village where he was living then. And then he got a master's in international finance, trade, and economic integration from the University of Denver. Since completing his master's in 2006, he has worked as a lobbyist on Capitol Hill, started a business with his wife, became an active stock trader, which I think he still is, and in 2010 founded Dominate the GMAT. Brett, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I look forward to talking with you and your listeners.
And it's a pleasure having you here today. Now, how did you get involved in the test prep business? I mean, from the Peace Corps to Capitol Hill to nutrition business, it's stock trading doesn't quite all fit together. So how did it happen?
Yeah, let me make sure that everybody on your podcast trusts me right off the bat. So I'm just going to tell the truth.
Okay.
I was looking for a way to make some money when I was in graduate school myself. It's literally as simple as that, right? I mean, you take out student loans, you're in business school yourself, and you're looking for ways to make a little extra money while you're in school. And so I caddied on the weekends, and I was looking on Craigslist for some part-time types of jobs that I can do, and I came across an ad for, you know, GMAT instructors, actually, for a company based out of Denver, Colorado, and applied, and I thought to myself, hey, you know, I did well on these tests myself, and so maybe they'll hire me, and sure enough, they did, and it turns out I absolutely loved the process, and that's why I'm still doing it, you know, 10 years later.
And how did you come to found Dominate the GMAT?
Mostly because I saw a need for online test prep. You know, 10 years ago when I started teaching the GMAT and the GRE in a classroom environment, kind of this whole world of online education, online prep didn't really exist. And so I went into a classroom several nights a week. I taught my 3 hours. You know, I kind of went back and forth with my students in a very traditional type of prep role. But about 5 or 6 years into it, I really started to see a demand, frankly, in the industry for more flexibility among the students. Look, if you're listening, you're busy, right? You probably have a full-time job, maybe. Maybe you have a family, you have kids, you have other hobbies, you have other interests. And the idea of being locked into a set time period every Tuesday night for 3 hours for the next 8 weeks of your life or 10 weeks of your life or however long it is, it can be very restrictive. And so there's obviously a huge need for test prep. Clearly, if you're going to keep up with the Joneses, if you're going to compete, if you're going to get into the best schools, you've got to take some sort of prep, but you don't have to sacrifice your flexibility in life to be able to do that. And so that's kind of why I ventured off and created Dominate the GMAT with an eye towards this online delivery of test prep that's proven that works, but in that kind of online method.
And dominate the GRE, which I think by the time this recording is posted will have opened, right? When is the open date?
It's supposed to launch this week, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. If you're listening to this and you go to my website and it's not live, I apologize, but you can actually email me or reach out to me directly, personally. I'll get you some information. But it's going to be here in the next few days to, you know.
Yeah, well, we're posting it later, so I don't think you have to worry about that. I'm sure by the time it is up, I don't have the posting date. Probably will be July 22nd, so I'm sure by then it will be up. But
perfect. Yep.
And if it's not, then again, reach out to Brett. But
that's right.
And so when you say online education, I think it means lots of different things to lots of different people. Does it mean recorded videos? Does it mean exercises? Is it Khan Academy? Is it forums? What does it mean in Dominate the GMAT and Dominate the GRE?
Right. So Dominate the GMAT and Dominate the GRE primarily focus on more of the on-demand delivery. So the instruction comes from videos. They're pre-recorded videos teaching all aspects of both the GMAT and the GRE available on demand. But I think one of the things that's a little bit different about what we do is we try to recreate the classroom feel, meaning, you know, what you get with Dominate the GMAT or Dominate the GRE is very much like what you would have gotten in a traditional classroom sense 5 years ago, 10 years ago. You get a detailed course syllabus that walks you step by step through everything you're supposed to do each and every week. You know, you need to learn this content, do these homework problems, take these practice tests in such and such a time, so that it's a very structured, detailed rollout of the information in a proven way, right? The concepts build and progress on each other as you go. And so all of that's the same. The only difference is, instead of having to drive across town and sit in a classroom for your 3 hours, you sit in front of your computer and watch video instruction. And I've really made an effort to make sure that my videos kind of recreate that classroom experience. They have that feel. I try to interact with you. I ask you to, you know, literally press pause and practice doing the problems on your own before you watch how I solve the questions. We have a little bit of fun. I make some terrible jokes. You know, it's that type of a thing. But I'm actually standing in front of a whiteboard, kind of like it would be in a classroom. And so it recreates that classroom experience for people who are used to that, but in the online delivery method. And there are, you know, there's ways to interact now online, right? So you can post comments directly in the forum, in your membership area, under the videos. I can respond directly to those in line. You can learn now from your colleagues who maybe have posted questions as well that maybe you hadn't thought of, see how I responded to those. And so it actually creates an environment where, you know, a lot of people ask me, I get students all the time who really feel like they want to be locked into the traditional kind of classroom approach, and they're a little hesitant, a little skeptical about this whole idea of online education. But once they get into it, it's a lot more robust. I mean, you can actually dive a lot deeper, get a lot more nuanced, have a lot more interaction, and I think learn well beyond what you could in any sort of a classroom environment. So,
okay. Now, when you did a webinar for us a few months ago, I think it was a three-part approach. I have it written down here. Your three-part game plan to dominate the GMAT. And at one point you gave some kind of sample problem with geometry. And I was just amazed by the clarity with which you presented that.
Thank you.
A long time since I studied geometry, and it was really, really clear. Well done.
So thank you.
That was excellent. Now, what if somebody is, you know, they watch the video and for whatever reason, it's not going in. They're struggling with whatever concept is being presented, whether it's for the GMAT or the GRE. What would you recommend that your student do at that point?
Well, if they're one of my students, they would continue to work with me personally, directly. I think that's one of the things that's nice about a smaller firm like mine is that one-on-one personalized touch, right? I'm accessible by phone, by email, and I even do a live office hour session, a couple nights a week. And so if the student's wrestling with a particular topic, let's work through it. Let's do as many practice problems together. Let's really hammer away. Let me see if I can help you think about it in a slightly different way. And that's one of the things that I think students get so locked into thinking about certain types of problems in a very traditional type of a way. Maybe they're struggling with the topic or the concept because they're trying to solve it in a way that they learned way back in high school algebra, for example. And so my job, and I think the role of any good instructor, is to think of alternative ways, analogies. Okay, you're not quite getting it this way. What if we look at it kind of in a 180-degree different view and see if that enlightens anything? So, you know, I I would just continue to work with the student and help them make those breakthroughs.
Sounds good. And you also have, you do have email support. Are you the sole provider of support, or do you have other people also available to provide support?
No, I am the sole provider.
You are. All right. So they get right to you. Okay.
That's it.
Now, there are lots of test prep companies out there, and there are also online options, both in companies that are exclusively online and companies that are both online and offline, traditional and non-traditional. What do you feel is dominate the GMATs and dominate the GRE's main contribution or distinctive, unique value proposition, unique contribution to the marketplace?
Yeah, and I think I appreciate your compliment earlier from the webinar that we did previously. I think that's a big part of it. You know, at the end of the day, and the big part of it is my teaching style, my clarity, for lack of a better word, to answer and explain concepts. You know, at the end of the day, all of these firms, if they're doing it right, should be teaching roughly the same stuff. And so here's my encouragement to you, the listener, right? These are beatable tests. The GMAT's a beatable test. The GRE is a beatable test. It doesn't mean you're going to beat it, but everything that's on it is known. In other words, there's not going to be any secrets. It's not like you show up and there's this roulette wheel of possible questions that you've never seen before that you may get. We know what's on it. We know you have to learn quadratic equations. We know you have to find the area of a triangle. We know you have to, on the GMAT, know certain grammar rules, certain vocabulary on the GRE, and so forth. So we should all in the industry be teaching that core fundamental stuff. Where I think the differentiation comes in is in the delivery of that content. And I think one of the things that students really like about what I do is just my clarity of instruction, my ability to kind of synthesize the more complex topics into a form that will help them get right answers. And I think ultimately that's what we're about at Dominate the GMAT and Dominate the GRE. I'll tell you a funny story. When I was interviewing for my first GMAT teaching job back in 10 years ago, and here's kind of the irony. I actually took the GRE to get into my graduate program, my graduate business program, and they were hiring me for the GMAT. And so be careful out there. You never know quite what you're going to get as an instructor. The good news is I ended up being pretty good at teaching the GMAT as well. But I remember, the guy who was hiring me, he gave me a sample set of questions and kind of locked me in a room and said, okay, answer these questions. He wanted to make sure I was able to do these, right? And I remember I got to this question, and it was really hard. And I looked at it, and I was like, oh, man, I'm in trouble here, right? He's expecting me to get this right. I wonder if I don't get this question right, if he's going to hire me, what do I do? Because I couldn't quite remember the very traditional. I couldn't remember how to solve the problem. And so I had to get creative. And I literally kind of used my creative brain to think about other ways of attacking it. Are there some ways that you can still – and here's my question for you, the listener. Are there ways you can still get right answers even if you feel stuck, even if you end up not quite knowing the best way to proceed on a problem? And the answer is yes. You know, I ended up thinking about a way to do it, got the problem right, and so forth. And what I realized is that's what matters. At the end of the day, these tests are a means to an end. And let's just call a spade, right? You're not taking the GMAT or the GRE because you want to, because you want to spend a couple hundred dollars to sit there in this room and be all stressed out. Who cares, if you know these obscure quadratic equation rules that you didn't even know back in high school, let alone care about today, and yet it's a mean to an end. You have to take these tests to put yourself in a good position to get into the graduate program that you're going after. And so what if I teach you how to get right answers? Yes, I'll teach you some of this other stuff too, but I think a lot of firms, and believe me, I own all the textbooks that are out there. I actually took a prep course myself, so I'm familiar with what's taught. And I think so many times these companies and these books get very academic, almost for academic's sake. Like, I need to show you how smart I am, and let me give you all this information and hope that you can synthesize it. But what if I digest it for you and help you focus on the most commonly tested question types and patterns, and oh, by the way, show you the best way of looking at these problems to get right answers, regardless of whether your high school algebra teacher would have been proud of you or not. And so I think that's a little bit unique about what I do as well.
Okay, great. Let's talk about the tests themselves for a second. I'm applying to a program, let's assume an MBA program right now. Actually, before I ask that question, what are some of the fundamental differences between the GRE and the GMAT?
Well, let's start with where they're similar. right? Okay. They both have an essay component, they both have a quantitative section, and they both have a verbal section. And so there's actually a lot of overlap. In other words, if you have already been studying for, say, the GRE, and you feel like you want to switch gears and tackle the GMAT, it's not like you're going to be starting from scratch. But problem solving is problem solving. Both tests have problem solving, which are kind of the traditional run-of-the-mill math problems. You're going to see it on both tests. Both tests have reading comprehension, which is kind of a very traditional basic. I'm going to give you a passage, ask you questions about it. Both are going to ask you to write an essay where you analyze an argument. So there's a lot of overlap there. Some of the differences are certainly in, though, the unique content to each. On the GRE, you also write an issue essay, whereas on the GMAT, you don't have a second essay. Instead, you have this integrated reasoning section. And we can debate the merits of how important that is and whether admissions offices even care about that score, but regardless, that's kind of a difference. On the verbal section, you know, if I were to kind of summarize it, I would say that the GRE on the verbal side is a little bit more vocabulary intensive, whereas the GMAT is a little bit more grammar and logic intensive.
Okay.
Right? The GMAT has a verbal section, a question type called critical reasoning, where you're supposed to analyze and evaluate arguments. The GRE doesn't have that. The GRE has questions where you have to have a rich vocabulary to find the right word to complete a sentence logically. The GMAT doesn't have that. The GMAT has questions where you have to pick out faulty grammar. The GRE doesn't have that.
Right.
And so it's kind of a big picture. The GRE verbal section is a lot more vocabulary intensive, whereas the GMAT's a little bit more logic and grammar intensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the math section, it's kind of splitting hairs. I mean, the GRE has the quantitative comparisons, which is a very novel, unique way of kind of thinking about math. The GMAT has data sufficiency, which is a novel, unique way of thinking about math. I don't necessarily say one is easier than the other. They're just different. You're going to have to kind of learn whichever one it is, but that's how they're different as well. So I think that's kind of the big picture differences.
If I'm a student who has a choice, I mean, for most graduate students, you don't have a choice, let's face it. But I'm an MBA student, and I have a choice between the GMAT and the GRE. Which one should I take? Is it a matter of which school I'm applying to, in your opinion? Is it a matter of where I'm going to do better? Maybe I take a practice exam in each and I figure out which one I score more highly on. What do you recommend?
I would start with the end in mind, and I would think about what program you do want to apply for, first and foremost, right? It used to be that everybody felt the need to just go get an MBA. And to get that MBA, you had to take the GMAT because it was really the only test that was accepted by MBA programs. But an MBA isn't necessarily ideal for everybody. My wife, for example, wanted very specifically a Master's of Finance. I got a Master's of International Finance. I didn't get a traditional MBA. And it was because we felt like it was going to be a degree that was more suited to exactly what it is that we wanted to accomplish in our career. And so first and foremost, be encouraged that now you actually have choice. That's a good thing that schools are now accepting the GRE. And oh, by the way, you may actually fare better in a non-traditional MBA type of a program if it's going to be in line with what you want to do career-wise. So always I encourage students to start with the end in mind. Now, in terms of the tests themselves, I think it absolutely makes a ton of sense to go ahead and take a practice test of each. Why not? You can get free practice tests from either ets.org or mba.com. Why not see where you currently stand? Even still, though, you can learn to master either one. You know, if I were going to throw a broad blanket out there and just kind of looking at the analytics, you know, for whatever reason, so I already touched on the verbal side of things, kind of big picture. If you feel like you have a better vocabulary, maybe you'll do better on the GRE verbal section. If you tend to be a little bit more kind of an analytical, maybe I'll kind of categorize it this way. If you're a little bit more creative-minded, artistic-minded, you can kind of see the forest, not just the trees, the GRE is more along kind of that line. Whereas if you're more linear thinker, you're more kind of organized mind, an engineer, you'll probably do a little bit better on the GMAT. And so, again, call me sexist, call me whatever. If I'm going to throw stereotypes out there, women may tend to do a little bit better on the GRE. And actually, the statistics kind of show that. If you look at women tend to do better on the verbal section. Yeah, the women tend to do better on the verbal section of the GRE than the men do. That actually plays out in terms of their average verbal score on the GRE. Not quite as well in the U.S., interestingly. So I think it's the international students, the international women specifically, who kind of drive up that average score. But on par, on average worldwide, women tend to do a little bit better on GRE verbal. Men do better than women historically on the GMAT, but again, it varies from country to country. So that's kind of broad blanket. I guess I would still come back and say, though, you don't start with the end in mind. You can learn to master either, but also make sure that the school you're applying to will look just as favorably. And Linda, maybe you can kind of weigh in with your thoughts on this. You know, do some of the top schools, the top 10, the top 20 business schools, right? Do they really objectively still evaluate and accept the GRE totally on par with the GMAT? So you have to have these conversations with the admissions officers and make sure that they will accept the GRE on par with the GMAT.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. When in the last several years, not initially when it starts first starting being acceptable, I would have these conversations and I still have them. And the answer always is we have no preference. And I think that my personal opinion, and I have absolutely no data or evidence to support it, is that if somebody, look, everybody applying to graduate school has to show, and I've said this over and over again, has to show they can do the work, they can perform, and they can perform well. No graduate school wants to admit a student who is struggling to do the work, keep their head above water. I mean, that's not whom they want to admit. So somehow, via the application, whether it's the grades or the test score, the applicant has to show they can, or work experience some way, they can do that work. If somebody has a really good GPA and evidence they can do the work, and for whatever reason is struggling with the test, I personally believe they're better off applying with a GRE because it's not calculated into the school's average GMAT. And the average GMAT has become a proxy for student quality, not just in U.S. News, where the GRE is actually also calculated, but I think in recruiters' minds and potential applicants' minds and donors' minds and alumni minds. It never was supposed to be like that, but I think it has become that. And for that reason, until the GRE starts to have this kind of psychic emotional attachment or meaning well beyond what it was intended for, I think that the student who's struggling with the exam is better off taking the GRE.
Yeah, it makes complete sense to me, actually. So okay, they want that score. They want that score posted on their website for all to see.
And at the moment, the GRE, because it's taken by a far smaller sample of students, it's just not getting that. First of all, most schools don't post it, though. I understand they're going to have to start. I think even when they do start, it's going to take a while before it kind of attains that aura that the GMAT has at the moment. I don't think it's a healthy thing. I think it'd be better if quality was understood to be a subjective element, not easily measured by a test score. But that's right. The way it is. What are some of the differences that you've seen, like in terms of MBA applicants approaching the GRE as opposed to other graduate applicants? Or do you see any difference? Is this the same?
Well, I think the biggest difference there is when you're applying for a traditional MBA program with the GRE, the schools are going to care about both scores. Because if you think about the GMAT, right, the GMAT gives you one score that's an aggregate of both your quant and your verbal, right? Mm-hmm. So even if you're a little bit stronger in one, you kind of have to be good at both. If you're going to crack 700 on the GMAT, you can't really have a glaring weakness. And even if you're a little bit weaker, say, in verbal than quant, it still has to be strong enough that when aggregated with quant, you're above 700. The GRE, of course, is scored separately. But the thing is, the business schools still are going to put a lot of weight on both scores. And so from that standpoint, traditional MBA applicants using the GRE still have to focus in both areas.
Oh, yeah.
Contrast that with the GRE, obviously, if you're applying, depending on what you're applying to, right? And so let's step back, big picture. The GRE is used for lots of graduate programs in general. I remember teaching the GRE once, and I had this student come in, and she said, look, I am applying for a master's of, I think it was sociology or something like that. And she said, you know, the admissions people flat out told me they will not even look at my quant score. They don't care. And so she, you know, I would start talking about quant stuff, and she would put in her earphones, and she would do Facebook all day. She literally didn't care. And she would take her practice test and literally wouldn't answer a single quant question. So she was solely focused on verbal. Contrast that with if you're going for a master's of economics, for example, or a master's of finance.
In STEM fields.
Yeah, those programs may tell you and have conversations with the admissions officers, but they may flat out tell you, we care infinitely more about your quant score than we do your verbal score. We don't want you to totally bomb the verbal section, but as long as we know you speak English, like as long as you're going to be able to read the stuff in school, we just care about your quantitative ability. And so I think there is that difference, and then that goes back to having the end in mind. Are you going for a traditional MBA where you're going to have to focus on all aspects of the test, or can you get a little bit more focused as you can on the GRE if, this is a big if, you kind of get that nod of approval from the admissions officers. Don't say, hey, I listened to this podcast, and Brett said, I don't need to focus on the verbal section if I'm good. No, you have to talk to the admissions officers, but that tends to be kind of something that's in the back of their mind.
I have a relative who he's in the STEM fields. He actually did his master's at Stanford, and he did great on the quant on the GRE, and he struggled with the verbal. Just really, really, so he studied it hard, you know, memorized vocabulary up the kazoos. It's just not his thing. He happens to be a very quiet fellow. And you know, my peer called me up after he got his score and said, do you think he should retake? And we talked about it, and we said, considering, you know, this was not new. He'd always been like this. He always had, was really strong in quant and math skills, et cetera, and not so strong in the verbal. He's very articulate. He just wasn't good at whatever they were testing.
Right.
So anyway, we finally said he shouldn't torture himself. What's the point? She thought, you know, he'd studied really hard. He'd done his best, and that's just what he's going to get. He did just fine.
Yeah.
You know, they just didn't care. Didn't care.
And if it had been a GMAT, though, that verbal score would have dragged down his overall score.
Correct.
And he may not have been as appealing, but with a GRE, they can at least kind of look at his score and say, wow, he's at least really solid in quant. You know,
well, so. I think, for the overall score in terms of, again, that kind of bragging rights issue that I talked about, I think that is certainly true what you're saying. I think that in business, you need to be able to talk, and you need to be able to communicate and calculate. So I think there's reason that it's important, that both are important and both are valued. And as far as the GRE in business school, they add them together. They get a total score.
Right.
So
that's
you
true.
Still have the
that's
total
true.
Score.
Yeah, you do. That's true.
You know, and I think ultimately that's going to, with time, it's going to become more influential, and you'll probably have the same issues. What are your top three GRE prep tips? Let's say, you know, again, for both areas, for the person for whom both areas count, not for the sociology major or the English major or the person in the STEM field.
Right. I would go back to my statement earlier that don't forget that these tests are a means to an end. And so my kind of top tip, especially on the quant section, is don't always think that you have to solve a question the traditional way, especially on the quant section, right? And it's going to take some time probably to untrain yourself a little bit from thinking along traditional lines. But I teach some strategies called non-traditional math techniques. And they apply a little bit better on the GMAT simply because the GMAT is all multiple choice, whereas the GRE has some of these numeric entry questions where you have to actually come up with an answer on your own. And so a little bit more so on the GRE than the GMAT, you actually have to know how to do the underlying math in a traditional way because you may actually have to solve for X. Whereas on multiple choice questions, which certainly applies on the GMAT and certain types of questions on the GRE, guys, you can kind of cheat. you can use a strategy called working backwards from the answer choices, right? Rather than setting up a problem, solving for X in a very traditional way and hoping you did it right and hoping the answer you get for X actually is one of the answer choices, you know, you can work backwards, for example. And in fact, if you head over to my website, Dominate the GMAT or Dominate the GRE, you can get a free session where I teach that strategy in detail.
If you send me the link, I'll add it to the show notes.
Perfect. I appreciate that. But at the end of the day, it's more of a mindset than anything. And I teach this mindset. It's called wouldn't it be nice if, WIBNI. When you look at a problem and it's challenging, you have to think a little bit creatively and say, okay, wouldn't it be nice if I could do this in a different way? Wouldn't it be nice if I had real numbers instead of variables? Great, make up numbers. Wouldn't it be nice if I could eyeball the answer on a geometry question, like the example I did for your listeners in the webinar we did a few months ago?
Yeah.
Well, good news, you can, under certain criteria. So you need to actually learn the rules of these strategies, but there are so many ways of getting right answers in a non-traditional way. So that's kind of my first tip is allow yourself to be a little bit creative. Don't get locked into the traditional approach always. I guess this applies to both tests as well. Read, and read some more. Right now, regardless of which test you're going to take, you will do better if you read more between now and test day. You just will. Both tests have reading comprehension, so the more you read, the better you're going to comprehend what you read. It's also where you develop vocabulary. It's where you learn grammar. So if you want to do well in the verbal section of both of these tests, increase your reading probably threefold, fourfold, fivefold compared to what you're currently doing, right?
Anything you recommend?
Well, of course, right? I mean, you don't want to just be reading John Grisham and Michael Crichton novels as you're going to bed at night. And so I actually have suggested reading lists on my blogs and so forth. But you need to read more academic type of stuff. I mean, the passages on the reading comprehension sections of both tests are fairly academic in nature, right? Maybe it's going to be about some aspect of biology. Maybe it's going to be something from history. Maybe it's going to be about black holes. Maybe it's going to be about business. Whatever it is, they're fairly dense stuff. So things like Scientific America, National Geographic, those types of publications are certainly helpful. Maybe your alma mater's magazine. You know, I get the Duke magazine because I went to Duke undergrad, and I get that magazine that comes out every couple of months. And it always has some interesting articles about breakthroughs that professors are making or something that's happening on campus in the medical center or whatever. And they're fairly dense in nature, right? And so that's interesting reading. But there's also no substitute for actual real former GRE passages or GMAT passages respectively. So go get some textbooks, hop online. There are sample passages online you can get. Those are valuable to read as well. And just one caveat there. Think about the topic that you dislike the most. Like if you're taking practice tests and something pops up about, I don't know, evolution or something like that, and you're like, oh, man, my eyes glaze over. I hate biology. I don't understand any of these terms. Read more of that stuff. Read your weaknesses. The stuff that you, right, because the stuff that's in your wheelhouse, that's easy stuff. So literally pick the stuff that you hate the most, because that's where you need to learn how to get right answers, even if you don't like the passages.
That's true. I wish I remember the quote. It was a great quote about a certain PhD who did something amazing, and somebody asked him, how did you get here? He says, well, I studied the things I didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, brilliant, brilliant insight. Yeah. And most of us are afraid of that, right?
That's right.
It's so easy to stay in our comfort zone.
That's right.
If you want to do well on these tests, you have to get outside your comfort zone a little bit.
And that's a little bit of what education is about.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And what about, that suggestion is for both tests, right? Or is it just for the GRE? Do you want to switch to the GMAT? What's your favorite tips with GMAT?
Yeah, those both apply. Obviously, there's a tip for the GMAT that doesn't really apply for the GRE, and that has to do with time management. There's a huge penalty if you leave questions unanswered on the GMAT. So, you know, one of my main tips right off the bat for people taking the GMAT, you can boost your score even without getting any more right answers just by literally not leaving questions blank at the end of the section. Because let's assume you completely guess on the last couple of questions and you get them all wrong. Of course, it's going to hurt your score a little bit, but it'll hurt it twice as much if you leave those last couple questions blank. So even if you do nothing else in terms of helping you get more right answers. As long as you just do that, your score will at least be a little bit higher than it otherwise would have been, whereas there isn't that penalty on the GRE in terms of leaving questions blank. So that's a big strategy, a big tip for the GMAT. I think the other tip has to do with these two quantitative sections that are unique, right? On the GMAT, it's the data sufficiency question type. And these questions take a little bit of getting used to because it's very, very different than any math that you've ever done. The math that you're used to doing requires you to actually get an answer, get right answers. Like you solve the problem and there's actually an answer and it's either right or wrong and you've got to get it right to get the question right. Data sufficiency doesn't actually require you to solve anything. It simply requires you to determine whether or not you could solve the question.
Right.
And that's a bizarre way of thinking. Well, Brett, how in the world am I going to know if I could solve the question? Well, there's lots of things to learn, right? That's why you take a prep course or buy a book or whatever, right? There's lots of strategies for that. But here's my challenge to you. Here's a little tip that I would leave you, kind of this mental thing. You always want to ask yourself, not whether or not you can actually solve the question, because you may or may not be able to solve the question, but could a Harvard math professor with a calculator, with a supercomputer, answer this question? And if the answer is yes, then you've been given enough information. And
but how would you know that? How would a mere mortal know that?
Well, let's say you hate work problems, like these work rate problems, where you've got one hose filling a swimming pool and it can fill a swimming pool in 3 hours, and this other hose that can fill a swimming pool by itself in 5 hours. How long is it going to take them if they work together, blah, 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 right? And so you sit there thinking to yourself, man, I hate these problems. Brett's taught me these problems 10,000 times. He gave me these great tricks for solving them, and I still can't solve these problems. Here's the good news. If they show up on data sufficiency, though, what do you know? As long as you know that work equals rate times time, right, for example, if the question says, how long would it take, right? What is T? How long would it take? What is the time if such and such and such and such? And one of the statements gives you the rate, and the other statement gives you how much work is done. Guys, they've given you two of the three variables. So I don't care if you can plug those into the formula and solve them or not. A Harvard math professor has been given enough information. You just have to know enough to know that they've given me two of the three variables. That's enough to solve, even if I can't solve it.
Right. And then you don't have to try and solve it either. You just see that you have the variables and you're done.
That's exactly right. So you're exactly right. Part of it, you still kind of have to know what you're looking for, obviously. It doesn't mean they're easy by any means, but it does require a little bit less of you because you don't actually have to solve it. You just have to know whether or not a Harvard math professor with a calculator could solve it, and that requires a little bit less kind of math knowledge on your part. On the GRE side, it's kind of the same thing. My overarching strategy for quantitative comparisons is compare, don't calculate. And there are ways to do that. It's another question type where you don't necessarily have to solve anything. You just have to evaluate the relative value, the relative size of two different quantities, which is bigger. Is this one bigger? Is that one bigger? That's kind of how quantitative, or are they equal? Do they equal the same thing? That's what quantitative comparisons are. But again, the trap so many students fall into is not only from a time management standpoint, but just from a kind of chasing it down a rabbit hole that doesn't need to be chased down is actually feeling like you need to solve these things. No, you only have to go far enough to know whether or not you could evaluate the comparative size, the relative size. And so it's a different way of thinking about these. But my caution, my tip is put on that hat, right? Adopt the hat of compare, don't calculate on the GRE for quantitative comparisons and don't necessarily solve, but simply ask, could a Harvard math professor with a calculator solve kind of on data sufficiency? It doesn't mean it's easy.
No.
Right? But it takes some time and effort to kind of get. I love it when I get an email from a student saying, finally, I just had the breakthrough. I finally get it, how these data sufficiency questions work. And then, boom, like overnight almost, their GMAT score goes up 30 points or whatever, just because they kind of had this breakthrough on data sufficiency. So you have to wrestle with it, right? I mean, the other tip is you got to put in the time and effort to master these tests. Just because they're beatable, there's still some work that's going to have to happen on your part to have these breakthroughs.
Last question. How much time do you recommend students give? Or is there a recommended time? Does it depend? Like if you want to have if you take a practice exam and you want your score to go up at least 50 points.
Right.
Total score.
I saw a study by the GMAC, so this applies to the GMAT, but I would say that it's similar on the GRE. Just objectively, they did polls of students, and on average to crack 600, which is a pretty good score, right? It's well above average. I know a lot of your listeners are going to be trying to get into the 700s to get into the top schools. But to crack 600 on average, students are studying about 100 hours. Interestingly, students who crack 700 are also studying about 100 hours. So 100 hours seems to be kind of the magic threshold for getting a high score on the GMAT. Now, there's not quite as much content on the GRE. There's just not. There's not as much, especially on the verbal side, right? Because there's a whole extra question type on the GMAT from a verbal standpoint, that critical reasoning section, which requires a lot more time, effort, and attention to learn, that simply doesn't exist on the GRE. So you're going to need to put a little bit more time into the GMAT than the GRE. But the other thing I would say is, and this is what I teach, this is kind of my sales pitch for my course, but it's not just a sales pitch, it's absolutely true, right? Efficiency, effectiveness of hours is a quality, right? Quality of hours is a lot more important than quantity of hours. So that 100 hours is irrelevant if you're either studying the wrong stuff or you're not studying stuff that's going to help you get more right answers. And so focus on the high-yield question types, the most commonly tested questions that you're going to see in each category. Learn how to get right answers more effectively, more efficiently, and so forth. And so you can definitely shave some hours off that. But in general, you're going to probably have to put in a couple months, right? What does that break down to? 10-ish hours, at least, yeah. 6 to 10 hours a week over a couple of months. Mm-hmm. That's the investment. So to think that you're just going to magically, the number one fallacy, right, is, oh, I'm smart, I should do fine on these tests. Can't tell you how many Duke undergrads, Harvard undergrads, whatever, sign up for my course, and they think that, okay, I'm an engineer. That I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten say, I was an engineer in undergrad, for goodness sakes. How come I can't master, you know, the GMAT quant section? Well, because you have to think about a little bit differently. Stop thinking like an engineer. This isn't engineering, that type of thing. And so the number one fallacy, again, is I am smart. I'm automatically going to do well on these tests. You still have to put in the time, effort, and attention to learn how to get how to master these types of tests.
Right. And there are also people who genuinely are smart, really smart, sometimes even managing MBAs, and they struggle with these exams. I don't have a good explanation for that. I always wonder, but I hear about it. Accomplished people.
Yeah. And I don't want to totally throw this on them because I don't know these people, but there's also an element of how you actually perform on test day, right? I'm an athlete. Yeah. So are you a gamer? Are you the type of person who does better in practice and then you totally freeze up in the game, you get all nervous, you never perform as well on game day as you do in practice, or are you the type where, and I happen to be this way, I for some reason, always there's that edge, right? If you get those butterflies in your stomach, it kind of means you're ready, and you always do a little bit better, you go a little bit faster, you hit the sweet spot a little bit more often if you're a tennis player or whatever on game day. If that's you, that's a good thing as well.
Yeah,
so
for sure.
It could just be that no matter how smart you are, if you freeze up, if you get nervous, whatever, it could affect your final score. And that would be kind of a little bit of a tip or advice for your students is just kind of have some perspective, right? You don't want to totally freak out on test day either. You have to be level-headed, calm, have the right perspective so that you can actually perform.
Good night's sleep.
On test day. Yeah, you got it. Yeah, obviously, get a good night's sleep. Dress for success. Show up dressed well. Don't roll out of bed in your pajamas and just drive to the testing center.
That sounds like is that going to be your last piece of advice for this podcast, or do you want to add something now? How'd you like to
know? Yeah, I think we joke about that, but the reality is what you do on test day does matter. You know, there are studies showing that if you actually dress up, you score higher on standardized
really?
Tests.
Really? All right.
Yeah, one of my students once told me the psychology term for it, but I learned that back in college, and I was always that dork, if you want to call me that. I was a loser who always showed up like dressed like I was going to a business interview while everybody else literally had rolled out of bed in their pajamas to show up for the test. But take a shower, you know, shave, do whatever you're going to do because that it plays into the psychology, the mentality of your mindset going into this thing. And so it actually is a real thing that translates to real results. The other thing is, you know, if you take care of your body will take care of you. The same thing with your mind. If you take care of your mind will take care of you. These are long tests. Right? These tests are more than 3 hours long. And one of the things, especially on the GMAT, right, where you start with the quant section and then you take the verbal section, you you tend to get mental fatigue. And so sometimes if you're struggling, for example, with a verbal section of the GMAT, it may just be that you're tired, that it's really hard to concentrate on reading comp 2.5 hours into this test. So have some Gatorade, you know, on your breaks. Just something to keep your blood sugar up, because your brain operates on sugar, on blood sugar and so forth. So little things like that will help make sure that you're, you know, you're cranking on all cylinders on test day and have the endurance, the mental endurance. And along those lines, and this is a very real thing, I know I use a lot of sports analogies, but if I asked you to go run a half marathon right now, right, could you do it? Maybe some of you could do it, but a lot of you couldn't do it. But here's my question. Could you train yourself to do it with enough time? You can actually train your muscles to physically have more endurance. And even if you couldn't do a half marathon, if you can run a half a mile now, you can train yourself to do a mile. You can push the muscular endurance. Like, that's an actual physiological thing. You can train your muscles to have more endurance. You can do the same thing with your brain. So if you are currently only able to really concentrate hard for 15 minutes, guys, you're going to have to work on that. And so one of the students, my students make
stop
one of the
texting.
Mistakes my students, stop texting, that's exactly right. And read, by the way, read for extended periods of time. But, you know, students ask me all the time, well, Brett, do I have to take these practice tests all at once, or can I pause them? Can I come back to them? I said, well, technically, or, you know, what you should do, technically, yes, you're allowed to press pause and come back to these practice tests. But should you do that? No, because you're not serving anybody by doing that. You need to get in the habit of sitting down and taking an actual 3-hour test, or 3.5 hours for the GMAT, right? You need to actually do that and train your brain to do that. And so that needs to be part of your preparation as well. So maybe that's kind of my last bit of advice, is kind of
sounds good.
Train. Yeah, you're going to perform how you practice. So practice well. Perfect practice makes perfect.
There's also data from GMAC that scores correlate to the amount of time you put in. I mean, I remember that, attending a certain GMAC day conference, whatever, and the correlation was striking between regions of the world that tend to do well on the exam and regions of the world that tend to study a lot, as opposed to those regions that study less and also don't do quite as well. In any case, we'll include links in the show notes at info.exib.com/112112 to any sites or resources that Brett or I mentioned in the call. And I want to thank you, Brett. Again, this has been very, very informative and very valuable. So thank you very much for joining me and for your time today. It's been great.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for all that you do as well.
Okay. Listener, thank you, too, for joining Brett Etheridge and me for our 112th episode. If you find the show worthwhile, I have a favor to ask. Please share the good word by leaving a review on iTunes. Your doing so helps us spread the good word about Admission Straight Talk, especially if you leave 5-star feedback. So if you think AST deserves those 5 shiny stars, please let iTunes know. There's a link in the show notes to our iTunes page where you can leave a review. And if you have a question for me, please ask it at info.exib.com/112. Again, that's 112. Or by sending an email to questions@exib.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Exib, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.